So, good afternoon, everybody. Good to see you. So, let's check the sound. Tim, can you hear all right back there? Good, good. So, if I begin to fade out, just give me the high sign, okay? So, the title of the talk this afternoon is The Sacrament of Reconciliation. And my teaching colleague, Paloma, and I were talking. She had been back to Los Angeles for a teacher transmission ceremony. She was with her teachers, Trudy Goodman and Trudy's husband, Jack Kornfield, and they were passing authorization to teach the Dharma to Paloma and a handful of other teachers. And Paloma said that the ceremony was just remarkably powerful for her. I remember one time being on retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh, and Kathy and I were with him, and we were taking refuge. We were taking refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. And I thought, gosh, this is one of the most powerful experiences I have ever had. I mean, it was in a totally uninspiring place. It was at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, the field house there. I mean, it had no aesthetics at all. But the presence of Thay's person and his teaching were simply so powerful. It was frankly more powerful than my Christian ordination. So Paloma's having one of these powerful transmission experiences, and she said it was as though something was really being passed on kind of hand to hand. We say that the Dharma is really practiced or passed on from warm heart to warm heart. And I think that really, that captures something about the nature of good teaching in whatever tradition it is. So then she said Jack Kornfield was giving kind of his pith instructions, his core instructions to these new teachers. And he said, you know, what we're teaching here is not confined to any one tradition. Like the Buddhists don't have a corner on this market. And to make his point, he read this story from Frank Ostoseski's new book, The Five Invitations, Discovering What Death Can Teach Us About Living Fully. Frank Ostoseski, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, he's the head of the Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco. So I want to read you this little story. Matthew was a gay man and a longtime Buddhist practitioner, hospitalized with pneumonia related to his HIV diagnosis. He was running a high fever, occasionally crying out and constantly writhing and wiggling in his bed as if he wanted to crawl out of his own skin. Matthew was also battling the inner critic who, in his case, was dressed in the robes of spiritual authority. He had been overtaken by anxiety, fearing eternal damnation, as well as shame at how he had lived his life. Matthew had been raised in a fundamentalist Christian family. The commandments of a punishing God had literally been beaten into him by his fire and brimstone preacher man of a father. Now believing he was close to death, he felt certain that God would condemn him to eternity, to hell, due to his sexual orientation. It's not uncommon for long-buried cultural mores and early religious training to suddenly resurface at the time of death, even if the person has deliberately left those beliefs far behind. I tried to support Matthew by orienting him to the mindfulness and compassion practices that he had studied and loved for many years. We created an altar at his bedside with his beloved Buddha statue and a healing thangka, a traditional Tibetan painting. When that failed to calm him, I held his hand, massaged his feet, and played his favorite chanting music. Still no change. Finally, a doctor offered a sedative. Even that didn't work. Matthew was spinning in a world of confusion, shame, and dread. By 2 in the morning, I was exhausted and feeling ineffective and powerless and chose to go home and get some sleep. On the drive there, for some unknown reason, I thought of my first Holy Communion, the Catholic ritual that ushers young innocents into the loving lap of God. When I got home, I searched through my storage closet to find my memory box, a small collection of mementos that I hold dear. Here, I located a 5-inch plastic figurine of Jesus, surrounded by lambs and little children. Instead of going to bed, I drove straight back to the hospital. As Matthew continued to moan, shout, toss, and turn in agony, I took down the thonga and replaced the Buddha statue with this small plastic Jesus. Just as I was smoothing the altar cloth, a cleaning woman named Dina came into the room and spotted the figurine. Setting her mop to one side, she said with great enthusiasm, "Merciful Jesus, when His kindness is with us, everything is all right." At once, Matthew's eyes locked onto Dina. An angelic smile spread across his face as he pivoted toward the altar to gaze at the plastic Jesus and then back in Dina's direction. His entire body relaxed. In that moment, the punishing God of Matthew's childhood, the one whose wrath he had been taught to fear and whose judgment had made him feel like a terrible person, was transformed into the merciful God he also knew and loved, the one who adored all his children, no matter their so-called faults and flaws. A kind, forgiving, all-accepting, benevolent God. Dina's faith in God's love was so secure that it lent Matthew exactly the strength he needed to defeat his inner critic. I left them together there. They didn't need me. When I eventually returned to the hospital later that afternoon, Matthew was sitting up in bed, smiling and eating a bowl of Jell-O. Most of us have notions from our childhood religious experiences about how a good spiritual person ought to function in this world. I'm a Buddhist, so I'm not supposed to get angry. Matthew had been raised an evangelical Christian, and so he wasn't supposed to be gay. But really, these ideas are just our inner critics projecting themselves onto every dimension of our lives. The voice of the authority figure who lives in our heads can just as easily come from cultural conventions or religious canons as from parents or teachers. Matthew was able to release his spiritual superego. In the final days of his life, he was truly able to accept himself as the kind, giving, beautiful man he had become. He could see clearly that the delivery system of his youth, the hellfire and brimstone and judgments, was the cause of his self-rejection. He had always felt on some level that he was wrong for being gay. But finally, letting go of his inner critic, he realized that he was all right. How did this happen? With love. Love's what sets us free. Love is the ally that makes acceptance possible. I got a call this weekend from a man who had a friend who had ended his life by suicide. And the leading edge of the call was this man was asking for some guidance about how to structure a service, really a backyard memorial service for this friend of his who had died. And so, you know, we talked a little bit about that, but the real important part of the call was talking about who his friend was for him and how much he loved his friend and what a sweet, kind man his friend was, and how loss after loss had punctuated this man's life, and his despair in the end had led him to end his life, this earthly life. And it got me to thinking about this inner critic, this violence that we can do to ourselves, and the power of spiritual presence, spiritual guides, spiritual teaching, to bring some healing love into that setting. I brought along this statue of Mary that I keep in my office. It's actually in my sight line. It's behind the one of the chairs where the people who come to see me sit. And she's, for me, a embodiment of this unconditional, maternal holding that is able to transmute, transform even the most relentless self-violence. I was talking with a man who had lost his job. It was a well-paying job. He wasn't all that fired up about his job, but he really missed it when it was gone. And he has spent really a couple of years trying different things, but you know, when you lose your job in your early 50s, it's often hard for somebody to want to hire you. So he has now been reduced to taking a very menial service job, and it's an enormous blow to his self-esteem. And as he sat down to talk with me about it, he said, you know, I'm just nothing now. I'm nothing. And he said, I just feel so overwhelmed. And then with great sarcasm, great self-contempt in his voice, he said, well, I guess I'm supposed to rise like the phoenix from the ashes now. You just hear the self-hatred in his voice. And we just let that kind of just sit out there in the space for a little while. And I said, well, you know, maybe now isn't quite the time for you to rise like the phoenix. Maybe now is the time just to be with how badly this hurts. So we were with this hurt for a while, and we began to hear this kind of dyadic voice. On the one hand, there was this voice that said he had blown it, he had failed, he had wasted his life, he was not going to be able to support his family, and he just was not going to make it. And then there was this voice that or this receptor of this critic, this rejecter, this judge, this part of him that felt so humiliated and so ashamed, so despised. And we know a lot about his growing up, and we know where this came from in his family of origin. He came by this nobly, as we say. And I said that I wanted to point out both of these voices. I pictured them kind of as these little circles in my hands. And I said, and they're these affects, they're these feelings that are connecting these two sides of yourself. I really think of them almost as opposite sides of one coin. They're like heads and tails. You don't get one without the other. You don't get the shamer without the shamed. You don't get the rejected without the rejecter. So both of them were there. And so because he's been practicing a little bit in the way that we've been practicing in here for the last couple of months, I asked him as best he could to simply step back from those voices, those figures inside of him, and see if he could simply unhook and just watch them. As though they were almost characters up on a stage, and he could just be sitting out in the audience and watching them. And so as he did that, he began to get a little bit of breathing room, and you could actually see his body, his shoulders relax a little bit, but his brow was still really furrowed, you know, he's just kind of like this. And I said, so I want you to try something that we've never done before. I said, I want you to see if you can take the voice, the presence of this judge, and the presence of this one who is judged, and I want you to see if you can begin to merge them in your mind, if you can bring these together. And as he did this, you could see his body. He didn't have to say a word. You could see his whole forehead just relax and drop into a place of peace. He actually, his body is the way we're doing in the meditation. His breath dropped down, and you could see his body become grounded. And he said, you know, all this whirling I've been doing in my mind for this moment, it seems to be quiet. It's quieted down a little bit. I was doing some work with a group of people who are learning to teach mindfulness. They're working at the Osher Center. Catherine and Patrick are part of that group. And we were talking about this dyadic presence of the shamer and the shamed, the judge and the one being judged. And one of the members of the group, herself a therapist, said, you know, I've always conventionally learned about, you know, you need to kind of stand up to your inner critic and take care of your inner child and, not let that inner critic just bully you around. She said, I don't think I've ever really kind of stepped back and seen what awareness itself, capital A awareness or presence, does in relationship both to the judged and to the judger. And what happened with my client was that as he stepped back, he noticed, oh, the way that awareness, consciousness itself, is relating to the one who's shamed, to his shame, was that it was entirely compassionate. It was entirely accepting. But what surprised him and surprised the therapist in my group was that this awareness was equally compassionate with the judge. That was the big surprise. That was the big shift. This winter, I was visiting my son, Alex, up in New York, where he's a student at Columbia Law School. And I knew that Thomas Merton had been a student at Columbia. Merton had been a student at Cambridge, and he had basically blown up his life there. And his mother and father had died. He was an orphan at 15, and his mother died when he was about 6 years old, so he was under the care of an uncle, and this uncle said, you gotta get out of England, you gotta come to the United States. And so he came to Columbia and enrolled there. And one day Merton was just, you know, he's just walking around the Columbia campus, and there's this Catholic church which is right by Columbia. It's called Corpus Christi. And Merton wanders into this church. It's kind of a dark place, and nobody else is in there, but there's a young woman who's sitting in one of the pews, and she's kneeling and she's praying. And Merton is so moved by the quiet concentration of this young woman that he gets curious about what's going on in this space. And to make a long story short, that was the beginning of his conversion to Catholicism, and I certainly would not be up here teaching had he not been converted to Catholicism. As Merton continued to go to Corpus Christi, he began to have a thought about, you know, maybe I'd like to become a religious. I'd like to join a Catholic order. And so he looked at the various Catholic orders, and he liked the teaching of St. Francis, and he said to himself, I think I'll apply to the Franciscans. So he knew a man who was a Franciscan monk and priest, and he went to talk to him, and this man said, I think you'd be a good candidate. And then Merton, in a sort of fit of youthful honesty, decided to confess everything that he had done in his life. And one of the things that Merton had done before he left England was that he fathered a child out of wedlock. And that mother and child had died in the London Blitz. And so Merton is sharing this with this Franciscan. And a couple of days later, the Franciscans told him that they didn't think he would be a good candidate for the Franciscans. Can you imagine what that did to Merton's inner judge? Yeah. So, you know, the story ends well. He ends up making his way to Gethsemane and becomes one of the most remarkable spiritual teachers of the last century. So when I was visiting my son, Alex, I happened to be up there with Kirsten, and we found our way to Corpus Christi. And I went in there by myself, and the church was dark, and I just sort of explored around and sat there and kind of felt into Merton's presence there and said some prayers of gratitude for his life. And then I made my way back to the confessionals. You know the confessionals that they have in Catholic churches? Some of you are nodding. There's these, in old Catholic churches, there are these boxes, you know, these where the priest sits and the other person sits on the other side of this screen. And it got me to think about the sacrament of what we now call the sacrament of reconciliation. And nowadays it's done really face-to-face and not so much in these old boxes. But that's the way it was done in the old days. And I think about Merton's religious life and really how he had to struggle with this inner judge, this inner shamer, and this person who felt so ashamed. He actually wrote a book. It's a series of his journals, and it's called My Argument with the Gestapo. All right? And the Gestapo is the inner critic. All right? Maybe you've got an argument with your own Gestapo. All right? I sure have. Here's something that just happened to come in my email box this morning from St. Mary Swanee. They send out these little daily emails. So, and this happened to be from Merton. And here's what he says. He says, let there always be quiet, dark churches in which to find refuge, where you can kneel in silence. Houses of God filled with silent presence. There, even when you do not know how to pray, at least you can be still and breathe easily. In these dark, quiet places, and Merton says someplace else, he says he loves walking around the streets of cities in Europe. He says because you can always find a quiet, dark church there and go in and find this refuge that he's talking about in this little passage. When we come into this quiet, we may stumble on some core beliefs. Talked about these a couple of months back. Core beliefs of I hate myself. You know, that was Eckhart Tolle right before his big opening, the thought that was pounding him into despair and hopelessness was, I hate myself. That was his core belief. And or the core belief may be, I hate you. Or it may be, I've failed myself. Or I've failed you. All these core beliefs lead to the wounds I have been talking about the last couple of weeks, the wounds of neglect and deprivation, wounds of abuse and trauma, and wounds of despair. The ordinary, familiar self, Buddhists call it the small self, Merton called it false self, whatever you want to call it, your personality, is simply too beleaguered to stand up to the relentlessness of the inner critic. I've said in other settings before that, you know, I've got a whole bunch of books on my bookshelf entitled, you know, How to Tame Your Inner Critic. And I just want to tell you, they don't work. At least they hadn't worked for me. But here's what does work, or at least here's what works for me, is to make this step back. In the Christian tradition, we would call this stepping back into the mind of Christ, or stepping back into Christ consciousness. Or Buddhists would call it the big mind, the Buddha mind. It's when we notice, here are these contents in consciousness. Here's all this shame, all this regret, all this sense of failure, whatever it is that you're carrying around. And this willingness to just unhook and step back from that for a moment, just to get a little bit of breathing room, and ask, how is presence, consciousness, the mind of Christ, Buddha mind, Mother Mary, how are they relating to both the shamer, you know, the hellfire and brimstone preacher man, and the one who's being preached at? How's awareness relating to both of those that are inside of all of us, whether we grew up in evangelical Christianity or not? It's there. How's awareness relating to those presences? And my own experience is like that of my client. My body tells the story. My body, my shoulders relax. My chest opens. My collarbones spread. And my eyes soften. What this does is it opens the heart. That's what the practices are all about. And that's what the teaching is all about. It's about one thing. And as Jack Kornfield said, we're not teaching or preaching out of one tradition, because all of the traditions have this in common. It's this, how do you soften the armoring around the heart and put the divine figure back on the throne of the heart? Because actually, that's where it always is. It hadn't left. We just need to see. It's been there all along. This is how the heart opens. It's not just by taking care of the wounded child. It's also by taking care of the tormenting, judging figure in there as well. So here's the deal. It's not an either or. It's not, I'm just going to take care of the judge or take care of the judged and we're going to push the judge aside. It's not an either or. It's a both and. They both belong. Why? Because they're in our consciousness already. They belong because they're there. Okay. Lisa Ernst, my teaching colleague with Paloma, sent me these Leonard Cohen quotes. I wanted to share these with you. This is Leonard Cohen. Nothing in this human realm is meant to work. Nothing in this human realm is meant to work. So once you can deeply appreciate that, the mind of compassion grows if you understand that everybody's up against it. Nothing in this human realm is meant to work, at least not permanently. The second quote, the greatest help you can get from anything is to find out it doesn't work. You know, really? I mean, really, therapy kind of gets good when the therapist and the client are both stumped and it's not working, all right? And then you got to be with that and figure out what happens after that. There's a little one-liner. I may have used it in here before. It's that the ideal is the enemy of the real. Have you ever heard that before? The ideal is the enemy of the real. And it's meant to be a counsel against perfectionism. It's like, don't be just insisting on the ideal of the time, all the time, you know. It's like, get real, let go of your ideals. But actually, as I think about it, I'm not so sure that the ideal is the enemy of the real. Because the ideal is there in our consciousness too. And if the ideals weren't there, we probably wouldn't be working for justice, for racial reconciliation, for care for immigrants, for all the things that we care about. So ideals are important too. Ideals can certainly lead to a kind of judgmental, harsh, perfectionistic voice. That's the downside of ideals. But I think it's a both and not an either or. It's not just the ideal or just reconciling yourself, or more like it, resigning yourself to the real, which often just leads to the idealist becoming a cynic. In fact, when we step back from both the ideal and the real, from the ideal, the critic who's got all these ideals for us about the way we're supposed to be and behave and think, and then the actual person that we are, you know, the person for whom things don't work sometimes. When we can step back into awareness and ask, how's awareness relating to this ideal? How's presence? How's the Spirit? How's Jesus? How's the Buddha? How's Tara? How's Mary relating to the ideal, to the judge? Check it out for yourself. And then, how are all these figures relating to the one who's crushed under shame and criticism and judgment and defeat and despair? So I want to end with the Good Samaritan. So everybody knows the story of the Good Samaritan, right? Everybody knows the parable of the prodigal son and the story of the Good Samaritan. So, you know, the man traveling on the road to Jericho has been beat up. Let's say he's been beat up by his inner critic. And you know, these religious figures come along. Like, you know, you want to join the Franciscans? Forget about it. We are passing by on the other side of the road. All right? It's the spiritual figures who are not available. That's a sad irony, but that's the way it works sometimes. And then, I mean the outcast guy. Did y'all hear the story about the two homeless men in Manchester? So, you know, they have had the bombing in Manchester and everybody is running to get out of that place. And these two homeless guys, they rush in to take care of the wounded. And they're holding this girl who's had both of her legs blown off. And they're holding this woman who is dying. How is it that it's the vulnerable person who understands vulnerability and moves toward the vulnerable? And that's who the Samaritan is. The Samaritan is the despised person. The Jews of the time thought that Samaritans were half-breeds. That was their take on Samaritans. So it's Jesus is saying, the religious people pass this person by. It was the vulnerable person who came and took care of this wounded man and put him on his donkey and took him to the inn and said, you pay and I'll pay and take care of him. So I want to suggest today that when we take the step back out of this tug of war between the shamer and the shamed, and step back into this gracious, compassionate awareness that, like the space in this church, is just holding everything without exception. Everyone. Everything without exception, compassionately. Then we stepped into the space of the Good Samaritan. That space is always with you because it's who we really are. It's not just the nice, good part of you, right? It's not your best self. You know? It's actually who we are. Our personality self, our small self, you know, sometimes we'll be compassionate and sometimes not so much. But this larger presence, this mind of Christ that Paul wants us to put on, this Buddha mind, it's got all the room in the world for all your shame, all your sense of deficiency, and for everybody else's too. And it's an inexhaustible fountain. It's always flowing. You can never run out of it. No matter how tired you are, no matter how exhausted, it's always there. So when Frank Ostasinski goes back and he finds that little plastic Jesus, I think that little plastic Jesus symbolized for him, oh, here's this larger goodness, which is larger than any one of us, and yet it includes all of us. It embraces all of us. So that's it for a little bit. So when the Buddha first taught metta or loving kindness to his monks, he said, so imagine yourself with someone who loves you deeply. He said, because nobody deserves this loving kindness in the world more than you do. So picture someone here with you who is just devoted to you, who's got all the room in the world for you just as you are. And that being may be a person in form. It may be someone who is no longer living on this planet. It may be a spiritual person. It may be Mary or Jesus or Tara or the Buddha. See who shows up. And then let this energy from the throne of her heart, his heart, flow into your heart. And hear their words as they say to you, may you be filled with loving kindness. May you be calm and peaceful. May you be safe and happy. And may you know the beauty of your own true nature, who you really are, and be free. And then you wish this back to this person who has so freely offered this to you, and you say, may you too be filled with loving kindness and held in loving kindness. May you be calm and peaceful and safe and happy. May you too awaken to the full beauty of your true nature and be free. And then we can bring to mind all of our dear ones, our human dear ones, our pet dear ones, our dear ones who are now in formless state, those on the other side, our dear ones who are perhaps not here in this city with us, but somewhere else on the planet. And wishing this for all of them, may they too be filled with loving kindness and held in the same loving kindness. And may they be calm and peaceful and safe and happy. May they know the beauty of their own true nature and be free. And we bring to mind those who have been terrorized, injured, wounded, frightened, strangers, prisoners, refugees, immigrants, people who have lost their place in the world, their sense of at-homeness. And we say to them from the bottom of our hearts, may you be filled with loving kindness and held in loving kindness. May you be calm and peaceful and safe now, and someday find happiness. May you know the beauty of your own true nature and come to freedom. And most challengingly, we bring difficult persons into mind. And persons who frighten us, challenge us, upset us. If you can go there, terrorists, harmful, political figures who do harm. And because this practice is meant for all beings without exception, we say, may you too, your heart be filled with loving kindness. May you be calm. May you know peace. May you be safe. Someday, somehow, may you find happiness. May you know the beauty of your own true nature and that of all beings, and come to the freedom of awakening. And so we send these wishes now to all beings in form, all formless beings. We wish that all beings be filled with loving kindness and held in loving kindness and know the beauty of their own true nature and come to freedom. We dedicate all the merit of our practice this afternoon to the welfare of all beings without exception, to the arising of joy and happiness and to the ending of suffering. So this is the fourth Sunday this Sunday, so there will be the Contemplative Eucharist at St. Augustine's Chapel on the Vanderbilt campus, 8 o'clock Sunday morning. The meditation and inquiry group that meets at my home on Sunday afternoons, 5 o'clock, number 10 Peach Blossom Square. And then Rami Shapiro, Rabbi Rami and I are doing a retreat on loving kindness at Skerrit Bennett. That'll be a one-day Saturday, 9 to 3:30 on June the 17th. So love to see you there for that. Any other announcements, anybody? Okay. So thank you for your kind, as always, attention, for your generosity and the Dharma baskets. If you Google One River Nashville, The beginnings of our new website are there. We'll probably finish it up this weekend, but you can get a foretaste of it there, One River, Nashville. So have a great week. See you next week.